Welcome to the Minerals and Royalties Podcast, the home of CEOs and investors in the minerals and royalties space.
Hey guys, this is Tim Powell from the Minerals and Royalties Authority. I recently sat down with Darren Geiger, CEO and Portfolio Manager of Cornerstone Acquisition and Management. During the episode, Darren discusses his views on the broader macroeconomic environment, including rising interest rates, the failure of Silicon Valley Bank, and how it all impacts the minerals and royalty space and the broader oil and gas industry. Let's jump into the episode and hear more of what Darren had to say.
All right, Darren, good afternoon and welcome back on the podcast. It's been almost 3 years, so lots changed since April 2020. And I'm looking forward to diving in here. You know, the impetus of having you come back on, you know, just everything going on in the macro environment, a lot of interesting things with Silicon Valley Bank failing and interest rates hiking up and looming recession around the corner and a whole slew of other things. That there's a few that I hold in high esteem in the mineral space that I think have a really interesting view on the macro issues, and you're one of those. So I'm honored and pleasured to have you back on, and I'm looking forward to a really thoughtful discussion.
No, thanks, Tim. It's a pleasure to be here.
Awesome. So really quick, you did come in. Anyone who wants to hear the Cornerstone story in more detail, by all means, go and check out the first episode. But let's just do a quick recap, Darren, just, on the history and, what you guys have, the story of Cornerstone, all that, what you've been up to in recent years. And then we'll dive into kind of current state of affairs, right?
Sure. The Cornerstone launched back in 2004 with a strict onshore oil and gas minerals mandate. We're always targeting large, diverse portfolios or patching them together through smaller, geographically concentrated assets. In terms of sourcing, we've always worked very hard to do more negotiated type of transactions, forging relationships, kind of a close-knit network within energy, and working directly with the sellers. Most of our larger transactions to date have been on the direct negotiated basis. Our team has been together for quite a long time. We all bring certain strengths here at Cornerstone that's created, in my view, a very cohesive and competent group. We're a little bit unique in that we've been California-based since inception. So we're out here surrounded by hydrocarbon hostility, as I call it. But as we've shown since 2004, you can manage minerals effectively from just about anywhere. We structured our mineral investments in relatively liquid private funds, which sat somewhere between, say, private equity, multi-year lockups, and publicly traded minerals-focused firms. And, as I look back, I think I attribute, our success that we've had in a very disciplined approach on the acquisition of assets, letting the market come to us, not chasing, and the continued implementation of a strong hedge book, especially in at extremes. So back in, going back a while, but 05, 08, Arab Spring. So things that really knock commodity prices for a loop, we're usually there to take advantage of that. Obviously, while we're looking at granular aspects of any portfolio we're considering kind of bringing in, the macro environment to us has always been something we spent a lot of time trying to understand, deciphering where we are in the cycle and how that impacts our minerals management approach and outlook, and then acting accordingly. Looking back, we've executed two exits, or resets as we call them. We sold in 2014 to Haymaker, and then again in 2021 to Kimball. The total of those two transactions was somewhere in the neighborhood of $220 million combined. We returned cash to our investor base, and right now we're looking for, again, more opportunities to take advantage of the marketplace. I'll finish with, addition to acquiring and managing mineral portfolios, this past year we launched another advisement arm of the business that works with commercial clients to assist in mitigating commodity price and interest rate risk, as well as those wanting more commodity exposure in their respective investment portfolios. So not just with respect to oil and gas, but other opportunities within the commodity sector as well. And in this environment, that's something that we advocate.
Hey guys, just wanted to take a quick break from the conversation and ask you to pull up April 10th and 11th in your calendars. If you're available and not already registered, be sure to go to mineralconference.com and get signed up for the Mineral Mark Conference being held at the Post Oak Hotel in Houston, Texas. If you're serious about deal making and investment in the mineral space, then I expect to see you there.
Well, appreciate the recap. Let's dive in now. I think I'll kind of start with a headline, and that's when you look at the last downturn, you know, forget oil and gas downturns. I know everyone will think about 2014-15, but broader economy, great financial crisis, 2008, you know, mortgage crisis, right? The recession we're in, or the recession we're on the verge of going into, is it going to be GFC 2.0, or is it different? You know, walk through the similarities, the differences between what we experienced, you know, coming on 15 years ago.
Yeah, sure. So as we see it, or as I see it, the Fed was woefully behind the curve by leaving rates way too low, way too long, and dismissing more recent inflationary wins. You know, that left them playing catch up to inflation, which again is the highest point in about four decades. So all of this has led to, you know, what do you do in catch up? You have to catch up. So it's led to this unprecedented rate hike cycle. So it's not just the level of where rates are, but how fast they've gotten there. And it's recently, as we've seen in the banking sector, started to break things and expose more problems. So with regard to banking, this isn't, say, a credit event like we saw back in the GFC with subprime mortgages. This is portfolio duration risk and liquidity problems and the management of such at these financial institutions. So the duration mismatch banks have to deal with is essentially lending long and borrowing short, and that has most of them sitting on mark-to-market losses on their portfolios. And those portfolios are typically long-duration, high-quality assets, but when, again, rates rise to this extent and they have to liquidate them like SVB recently had to, they're going to sell them at a loss. So inflation, you know, we've seen inflation kind of recede back down from a kind of a peak of 9 down to 6. However, in our view, the fight is far from over. And while inflation will come down further as the economy weakens, we expect inflation to remain higher than what everyone has been accustomed to. And we attribute that to, you know, tight labor, high services prices, high rents. In terms of energy, you know, the lack of CapEx on the energy side and heightened geopolitics and kind of this East versus West approach and tariffs, et cetera, that's not deflationary. So perhaps, you know, we don't settle at the 2% target, but we may settle at 4%. And so with that, that keeps pressure on rates. So the problem the Fed has, in our view, is that, you know, you can't fight everything at once with these blunt tools. So inflation and economic financial stability issues, you just can't tackle all of those at once. So if they are done raising rates and say pivot to cutting rates, and the futures expect, you know, 3 rate cuts before year end, what it'll do is it'll just turn into, you know, risk assets kind of ripping higher and once again stoking inflation. So in the end, the Fed may abandon the fight on inflation in favor of a perceived softer landing. And so that's our view, is that they're kind of in this cycle of, well, if they start cutting rates and inflation's still at 4%, you're just going to put more pressure on inflation rising higher, which again puts rates back in view.
You know, one other comment, you know, from a macro standpoint, just kind of the rising cost of goods in the U.S., you start to have, I don't want to call it the end of globalization, but I've listened to some podcasts that just talk about the dynamics of between China and, you know, Russia and Europe and the U.S. and supply chain breakdowns. And you see what's happening with cars. And now countries start to look at having, you know, supply chain security, starting to take those outsourced jobs and bringing them back to the U.S., even though they might be more expensive, you know, making sure you're not beholden to someone who has a different political interest, right? And energy security is just another version of that, that hits a little closer to home for you and I and everyone listening here. But that's going to lead to, you know, rising costs for everything. Any comments on that?
Well, I agree with you completely. I think you're starting to see, you know, more and more of this eastwards versus west approach. Obviously, the war in Ukraine is highlighting some of that. And then, you know, she's with Putin in Moscow. And then even more recently, you've seen some deals transact between Saudi Arabia and China itself this past week on the refining side and supply offtake. So there's definitely a lot of that going on. And I agree with, we're kind of in a somewhat of a nationalization type of environment that I think is going to last quite a while. And whether that's, you know, raw materials, bringing labor back in-house, and somewhat de-dollarization. So you're seeing a lot of these transactions try to move away from the dollar and price in yuan or what have you. So I agree with your premise that everything that we're kind of looking at outside of, you know, the economy is weakening, and that is somewhat deflationary, but you have a lot of inflationary kind of counter forces that are acting against it at the same time.
Now let's go on to what's topical, and that's Silicon Valley Bank. So I feel a little bit more educated on what's going on. I've listened to podcasts, read a bunch of stuff, but at the onset, it was, is this the beginning of, you know, the mortgage crisis, but from a bank perspective, and it's just going to be a domino effect. So the question begs, isolated event or a systematic risk in the broader financial system? What are your thoughts there?
I think, you know, now that we've had a little bit of time since when the crisis developed, I believe it's largely contained. There were a lot of things that made SVB stand out amongst its regional peers. Some of those are heavy concentrated deposits, which again led to the two problems of having to invest those large deposits in something generating yield, but also combined with the possibility that we saw and the reality of that those deposits may not be very sticky. And as reported, you know, the top 10 deposit accounts at SVB held over $13 billion. So it doesn't take much to, in that kind of situation, to cause, you know, somewhat of a run that then, you know, there's contagion that you have to worry about with others. And that's what we kind of saw with Signature. But after that initial weekend with SVB and Signature, there's been a concerted effort to limit the contagion. You had the top 11 lenders inject $30 billion into kind of the next domino that was next to fall, which was First Republic. And then you saw Citadel take a 5% stake in Western Alliance, which was probably fourth on the list. So you've had a lot of intervention come in, you know, not just from, you know, regulators and such, but also from banks themselves. And it may not be fully over, but seemingly contained for now.
Yeah, no, I think, again, as I've got what you alluded to, right? The top 10 deposits having $13.3 billion. I mean, I listened to one podcast with Med Faber, and he had a savings account specialist on. I'm forgetting a Max Money Interest or getting the name of the guy. Anyways, he's just saying when you look at a normal bank and you're FDIC insured, you know, 250 grand or lower, and you looked at the average deposit of, you know, the clients and SVB, and it was tens of millions. And so, you know, if you had a bank run and it was 50,000, 20,000, 100,000 versus 10 million, 15 million, quite different. So sure, that made it seem pretty unique. I think 92 or 93% of their depositors were non-FDIC, you know, insured, which made them a substantially more risky bank in the context we're looking at. But, you know, being said, with social media the way it is, you know, the old saying, reality is not reality, perception of reality is reality. Bank runs are fear driven. And so all it takes is, you know, a couple of posts and bots and, you know, grandma looking at it and saying, oh my God, let me go take my money. And it's far, far different than, you know, the local hometown, you know, driving by the bank and seeing a line out the door type of mentality. So
when my wife and my mom kind of pull me aside and ask me about it, then, you know, yeah, it's reached the stage of you know, whatever mediums they're using.
So Silicon Valley Bank, unique animal, seems to be, you know, some of the other dominoes, if you may, have, there's been some intervention and it seems to be in check. But from this, there's probably going to be regulation. And with regulation, there's safer behavior, you know, stricter behavior on lending. You know, most of the banks that lend to oil companies and to the broader energy space are regional banks, and they're gonna be more susceptible because they don't have the federal backstops that these, you know, too big to fail banks have, right? So talk to me about the larger issue at hand, really, if you may, around access to capital and energy and regional banks. And is this, I dare say it, just an excuse for more banks to get out, right? And just tap out and leave, and it's not really purely because of economics?
Yeah, look, I think you just hit the nail on the head. I mean, that's the larger issue at hand from my point of view in terms of energy capital. These regional banks are the most susceptible to the current crisis of that duration and liquidity risk, which includes numerous energy lenders, because they aren't the money center banks. They're not too big to fail, which is where those pulled deposits from the regional are going, to the JPM and the Bank of America's and City of Wells. So in addition, you know, to energy, I mean, regionals are some of the backbone of small business loans and account for roughly 70% of commercial real estate loans. So commercial real estate, especially kind of the office slice of that, in our view, is, again, the next shoe to drop. So, you know, office vacancies nationwide are currently around 18-19%. $500 billion of commercial real estate debt needs to be rolled each of the next 5 years. So again, that debt will need to be rolled at higher rates, which will also, you know, lower values for those properties. But banks overall will be much more selective going forward and cautious, having to shrink their loan books amid, like, as you said before, tighter regulations. And so while the cost of debt that we all know of has doubled over the past year, I think the bigger issue, as you said, will be access to debt and the contraction of credit. So, you know, what does that lead to? Tightening credit generally leads to, you know, higher default rates, and this lending uncertainty will throttle back on the energy side, oil and gas capital spending. I mean, if there's uncertainty, they're kind of frozen a little bit. So, you know, if you pan out a little bit on time, you know, during the last down cycle, a number of energy lenders exited space near the bottom of that cycle. And then more recently, you're seeing kind of the big major European banks are decrying funding future oil and gas, you know, firms or projects, you know, Barclays, ING, HSBC. And then on the insurance side, Munich Re has also kind of pulled out, or will.
And if you remember, Munich Re came in aggressive 5-6 mm-hmm. years ago, right? So it's a complete 180.
Yeah, it's again, we all know why. It's the ESG pressures, you know, kind of globally, and the narratives around that. So, and in fact, we had a taste of this at Cornerstone back during the European bank crisis about 10 years ago. We banked with Paribas at the time. However, once the bank started having, you know, issues, we had to monitor. We had deep in the money hedges with them at the time. We had to monitor that. And eventually they sold their energy book to Wells. But, you know, Wells wasn't a fan of the minerals model. So when they took over the whole book, they made it somewhat clear to us that, you know, again, minerals wasn't really their thing. So, you know, I'll give a shout out to where we landed, which was Amogy Bank. You know, we had to, you know, we looked around 3 or 4 different suitors, landed with Amogy, and kind of haven't looked back. It's been a great relationship. So again, just to kind of, you know, end on that point, I think, you know, banks are examining their loan portfolios all the time. And with what's happened, you know, energy just may not be worth dealing with the cycles and the politically misguided ESG, you know, pressures anymore. The shift will be to perhaps lesser known banks, higher costs, more restrictive covenants. So it's going to be tough.
Hey guys, I wanted to take a quick break from the conversation to say thank you to all of our podcast sponsors. Over the past 20 years, Riverbend Energy Group has been the definitive leader in the non-op and mineral space, where they are actively acquiring minerals in the Delaware Basin, Midland Basin, the Williston, and the Eagleford. Following their $1.8 billion sale of their non-op platform in 2022, they are also back actively acquiring non-op interests in the Delaware Basin, Midland Basin, and Williston. If you have minerals or non-op working interests in these areas that you would like to sell, then please visit www.riverbendenergygroup.com for more information. As a leading global energy business advisory firm, Opportune is well positioned to provide world-class technical, financial, and operational capabilities to minerals and royalties companies. Whether it's back office outsourcing, resource and reserve definition, land due diligence and administration, GIS mapping, valuation work, data and system integration, financial reporting, tax advisory, or buy and sell side assistance, Opportune LLP has got you covered. For more information, please visit www.opportune.com. Noble Royalties has been a leader in the minerals and royalty space since 1997. Noble's experience and world-class technical team will assist in delivering effective solutions to EMPs, mineral funds, and private owners alike to maximize the value of their mineral ownership in this dynamic market. To discuss effective mineral solutions, whether buying or selling, in the Permian, Haynesville, Eagleford, or Bakken, please reach out to Chase Morris at cmorris@nobleroyalties.com or Shannon Manor at smanor@nobleroyalties.com. Farmers National Company has oil and gas experts located across the country ready to provide you unmatched convenience and service for your land management needs. Whether you're looking for turnkey management of oil and gas interests or simply looking for an advisor to help you sell or lease your minerals, Farmers National Company has you covered. Learn more about Farmers National Company's team of certified mineral managers, landmen, attorneys, and accountants by going to fncenergy.com or reach out directly at energy@farmersnational.com.
Yeah, no, and what I've seen from my seat is the emergence of ultra high net worth and family offices entering the private credit space to fill the gap. And when you look at the upstream space, I think that is that's a problem that doesn't really have an answer just because of the scale of capital. But when you look at minerals and you look at lines of credit that are in the single millions or refinancing on some larger deals, refinancing different kinds of debt, you know, at the public level or in the private level, 10, 50, 100, these are reasonable levels that, you know, family offices can kind of fit in and fill a void there for a little bit. So I've seen that for sure. And other types of vehicles that are out, you know, raising capital of a mix of institutional and family office, but it'll be interesting to see how it plays out. But just, it seems that every cycle we get into, the number of banks continues to dwindle, right?
Does.
So now we've been talking about macro. Let's kind of go back and look at it through a minerals lens. You know, I think you can call it not a perfect storm, but just a combination of headwinds here that make it really interesting and challenge for mineral strategies, particular yield-driven ones, right? Would love your thoughts. You've talked about how you guys have used debt in the past and, you know, you've done it prudently and it's really bolstered financial performance. It goes back to just when you're managing a minerals portfolio, it's not just in the buy, it's maximizing it through a hedge book and being opportunistic in different parts of the cycle. So that becomes more challenging now when debt is, what, 8-9%? It used to be 3-3.5%. And you're looking at a lower type yield product like minerals, and it doesn't have the swings of working interest deals, you know, for good or for worse. It becomes really difficult to get the spread. It becomes really narrow. So, you know, all the things we're looking at, you got falling commodity prices, you know, inability to access debt, the costliness of debt. How does it all come together as a minerals manager and someone who's focused on buying PDP and yield from Cornerstone's eyes? So I'd love to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, with respect to mineral strategies, rates on debt have been somewhat of an afterthought until relatively recently, so 12, 18 months ago. And for those with significant debt capital or needing it, again, as we've been discussing here, the situation has just changed. You know, your typical RBL loans are 1 month SOFR plus 300 to 400 basis points. So that used to be 3 to 4, now it's 8 to 9. For your cost of debt, higher inflationary expenses at the operator level for labor, other materials, steel, and such have impacted budgets, CapEx. So while, you know, as we know that doesn't affect directly mineral groups, it does impact production growth at the operator level, which flows down to the mineral and royalty groups. So you have to be cognizant of that. And then, you know, Dallas Fed survey recently came out, and if you've read that, you know, all-in break-even prices in the Permian averaged about $61 a barrel, which is $9 a barrel higher than last year. And, you know, that same survey goes on to state that the cost inflation is operator's biggest concern related to profitability. So, you know, this past week, we've seen crude prices bounce off the mid-60s, 66.50 or so was kind of the low. And that was the lowest level than at any point during all of last year, 2022. So, and now we have gas again flirting with, you know, a one handle, which is about one-third the average price of all of 2022. So, you know, you, myself, everybody in the space, we're all used to commodity price risk. And you know, higher prices can mask a lot of the other issues. But when they're all hitting at once, like you said, somewhat of a perfect storm of low commodity prices. And again, crude's bounced back into the, you know, 77, 78 range, but gas is not. It causes problems, again, if you're dealing with all of these problems at once. So it does impact all yield strategies, as one can easily earn nearly 5% at the front end of the the rate curve riskless. So investors will need, a high enough spread over that risk-free rate to assume this inherent investment risk. And that spread can be harder to achieve when you have pressures mounting, not just on the commodity price side, which everybody, again, in our industry has dealt with for forever, but with debt, higher cost of capital, and stagnant production. So minerals now have to compete with also upstream E&P yields, which have become fairly compelling for some companies as they've routed cash flow back to dividends and paying down debt as opposed to the growth capex. If I look back at my career, I managed our funds through kind of the public oil and gas MLP era. And, these are strict yield plays. And as soon as they cut their distributions, you have investors just starting to flee. That's just the nature of yield type of investments. So you have to be cognizant of that too. I mean, these public mineral groups have to really pay attention to those distributions because, again, once they're cut, investors, they head out the door en masse.
No, that's interesting. I would say as a headline, you would think, the mineral space doesn't use a lot of debt. But really, when you start to dig in, everyone is using debt in some form or capacity. It's publics down to the small guys on the ground who are stretching their own dollars, right? So it impacts everyone. And yeah, on the public side, it's a really interesting point on if you get a little over your skis with the cost of debt and you need to slash your distributions a bit, and then all of a sudden that exasperates the problem. And now your stock starts to crater and then can't use your equity. You saw this in COVID. The publics in the US were very, very handcuffed because it was driven for different reasons. Outside of COVID, a lot of groups had private equity overhang and it was driving their stock down, but that they just couldn't compete, right? They couldn't use the value of their stocks to compete on deals. So you start to see different types of players come in and win those market processes, private equity hybrids of the lower cost of capital and some bigger family offices and institutions. So it'd be interesting to see how it all plays out. I think when there's challenges for some, there's opportunities that get created. And so, if publics start to be hindered by debt or yield players start to become challenged, maybe there's an opportunity to, for the white space guys or the longer term view guys, right? So it ebbs and it flows back and forth. But, all this kind of bring it together. How do you see things going forward? And what kind of time frame do you guys, take a view on? What are your thoughts over at Cornerstone?
Yeah, I mean, we always have a long term view in mind when we're looking to acquire. So, in my own view, I think the next 10 years are going to look drastically different than the last 10. I want to be in real assets, consumption, high demand consumption commodities like oil and gas, and obviously, our expertise is on the mineral side. We're very bullish on crude longer term due to growing global demand. Again, CapEx constraints, declining inventory of top tier acreage. I mean, we've all heard, the various reasons why supply will be constrained, and that's real. But also you add in the political narratives that just conflict with the most basic energy realities, and you've got a recipe for high volatility in some of these commodities that we aim to take advantage of. So again, we're very bullish on crude going forward. Gas is a little trickier in my view. I think you have to be a little more tactical in your approach to it. But, for us, I think right now, where gas is has landed recently, it's compelling. So we'll start looking more and more at gas heavy portfolios if we think we can buy them at value.
Hey guys, I wanted to take a quick break from the conversation to say thank you to all of our podcast sponsors. Your property is your legacy, so you should only leave it in the hands of a land management company who has a legacy of its own. If you own oil and gas interests or act as a fiduciary for those who do, you can find a long-term partner at Farmers National Company, who, since 1929, has taken great pride in helping clients maximize the benefits of property ownership by providing turnkey management services and by working alongside them through generational transfers of specialized assets such as oil and gas interests and farmland. To learn more, visit fncenergy.com or reach out directly at energy@farmersnational.com. Noble Royalties has been a leader in the minerals and royalty space since 1997. Noble's experience and world-class technical team will assist in delivering effective solutions to EMPs, mineral funds, and private owners alike to maximize the value of their mineral ownership in this dynamic market. To discuss effective mineral solutions, whether buying or selling, in the Permian, Haynesville, Eagleford, or Bakken, please reach out to Chase Morris at cmorris@nobleroyalties.com or Shannon Manor at smanor@nobleroyalties.com. Need energy industry management experience at your fingertips? Opportune LLP, a leading global energy business advisory firm, has the capabilities needed to overcome your minerals and royalties team's technical, operational, and financial challenges. To learn more, search Opportune's podcast E2B, Energy to Business, on Apple and Spotify Podcasts, where Opportune examines emerging financial and technology trends and provides a broad perspective on ways to stay ahead, create opportunities, and execute market strategies. For more information, please visit www.opportune.com. Over the past 20 years, Riverbend Energy Group has been the definitive leader in the non-op and mineral space, where they are actively acquiring minerals in the Delaware Basin, Midland Basin, the Williston, and the Eagleford. Following their $1.8 billion sale of their non-op platform in 2022, they are also back actively acquiring non-op interests in the Delaware Basin, Midland Basin, and Williston. If you have minerals or non-op working interests in these areas that you would like to sell, then please visit www.riverbendenergygroup.com for more information.
Unpack gas is trickier. I mean, my thought goes to just how large the spot market has gone for LNG and how dependent U.S. LNG is on the spot market. And so as, you know, gas kind of swings up and down, so does the competitiveness of the U.S. Is that what you're alluding to? Or
yeah, it's that. And it's just, you know, gas is more of obviously LNG has grown massively, as has pipeline exports to say Mexico and such. But again, it's driven a lot by what's going on the ground here domestically too. And so it just gets, you know, the curve with gas isn't like it is in on crude oil. So when you see moves on both commodities, obviously for various reasons, but it tends that the oil curve will move, kind of the time frame of the curve can move up and down much more than the gas curve can. So gas, you're kind of ruled by seasonality much more than crude is. And so it just gets a bit trickier. I mean, obviously, when we go to acquire any asset, we have a long-term approach, and we are long-term bullish on gas. But I think that, again, you need to be careful on your entry points, your price points of where you're acquiring the, you know, what you're modeling for your forward production and price on gas a little more stringently, or just with more margin for error on the gas side, at least right now.
Okay. And from a minerals perspective going forward, how are you all tackling opportunities, and what's Cornerstone strategy? Is it same old, or are you changing things up a bit?
No, I mean, it's hard to mess with what's worked. And so, you know, for us on our mineral approach, our strategy has always been to just kind of go, we're like water that you pour down a hill. We kind of try to go where value dictates. The most efficient route we'll take. So, you know, if you're left concentrating geographically, there's immense competition, as we've seen, obviously, primarily in the Permian. And what that does, obviously, is drive up prices, and it drives down your margin for safety, your margin for error, if you're competitive. So a lot, from our point of view, a lot of analysis goes into that, especially at the operator level. What is core to those operators in times of stress, commodity price stress? Is it still going to be a place where they focus operations? And if so, that's where we want to be. So again, you know, for us, we kind of take that. We also obviously look at the political backdrop on a more localized level. That's important. I mean, as I said before, Cornerstone's always been based here in California. We know it. Great resource base, but essentially untouchable with respect to private energy. The political landscape here toward hydrocarbons is just, it's insane. So I'd skew towards, you know, in summary, I'd skew towards liquids production, and absolutely focus on a strong hedging program in place, given what I expect on the commodity price volatility side. But again, that being said, right now with gas where it is, I probably equally focus on gas portfolios too, And, you know, typically over, you know, our career here at Cornerstone and our funds, we've always had a relatively balanced portfolio of, call it 65 liquids, 35 gas in general. But we don't want any undue concentration geographically tied to one operator. And so we do try to spread that diversity around a little bit. And I'll finish on the debt side. As you said earlier, we've always run kind of a very conservative debt draw. I think that's paramount here, again, given the cost. And then I think there's nothing but more restrictions coming, heavier covenants. And so I think it's going to be just something that those in the yield and mineral space especially have to be very, very sensitive to.
Yeah. Do you foresee, I mean, you talk about consolidation in the upstream space and mergers and all that. I think there'll be consolidation in the mineral space. I think the secondary market, you know, basins that were really frothy, like the Haynesville, folks who bought that with lines of credit, I think that mm-hmm. becomes an interesting thing to watch. What about on the debt side? Do you think there's consolidation, you know, rolling up distressed debt, if you may, getting it off the balance sheet of banks if they don't want to get rid of energy, and you get private credit funds coming in? Is there a play there? Do you see?
Yeah, there could be. I mean, anytime you have stress on the capital side, debt in this case, there's going to be opportunities for those that are cash heavy or looking to acquire assets at value. And so I do think that there's going to be a lot of opportunity kind of in the coming, you know, months and years for those type of opportunities, especially like we talked about a little bit earlier with a lot of these banks just simply exiting the space in general. There's going to have to be someone that fills that void on providing capital. It's just going to be more expensive. And so there is a play there, I believe. And then again, kind of on the upstream side of things in general, I just think that those with a strong balance sheet, and again, a lot of cash, can kind of dictate terms, if you will, and are probably going to take advantage of the situation to their benefit.
All right. Awesome. Well, Darren, I have one more question. Something you brought up earlier in the conversation, I just like to revisit and pick your brain. You talked about some of the de-dollarization that's starting to happen globally. I think that's a scary place to go mentally as an American, right? I mean, there's so much debt held in U.S. dollars globally. And if you ever got to something other than the petrodollar, you know, there's some huge implications there. When you talk about, you know, liquidity risk for banks and just how much U.S. dollars are held, these are global banks, right? It just, how does it all fit together? And, you know, some of the things that are happening with China, you mentioned the Xi and Putin meeting recently. You have Taiwan, you have the invasion of Ukraine. I mean, how far away do you think the risk of, you know, de-dollarization are we?
I think it's still a long ways off. It's just that it's, you know, as we write about sometimes, you know, people just assume that tomorrow is going to be just like today, and then you wake up and it's not. And so you do have to be cognizant of that. And it is going in that direction. I'm no crypto expert, but you can start getting into that realm too and such. But, you know, there is a concerted effort by those that necessarily aren't, say, on America's team anymore. I mean, it used to be where, you know, we dictated terms in the Middle East. That's not the case anymore. They just, like I said, cut two large refinery deals with the Chinese this past week. And in fact, you know, Russia's part of OPEC Plus still. And so those relationships, those dynamics are changing. I mean, you have, you know, China and India have just basically said, you know, they've ignored our, you know, U.S. sanctions on Iranian crude and Russian crude. I mean, they're grabbing it, you know, hand over fist as much as they can. And so, in my view, the U.S. just, it's almost like an arrogance thing that these guys aren't playing by our rules anymore. They're playing by, you know, what benefits each respective country, and they're making those decisions on their own. And so I think that, you know, all of that plays into de-dollarization, but it will take a while. I mean, you know, the crude contracts that, you know, that the Chinese have established trade, I mean, the trading volume of that is just a small fraction of what we see here in the States. So it's going to take a while, but it's happening, and we need to be, as a country, cognizant of it.
Yeah, no, I remember, so I'm in dialogue with several family offices in Mexico on an ongoing basis about coming into the mineral space. And I know when NAFTA was being renegotiated and all the Trump's not pro Mexican rhetoric, right, when he was president, there was a shift by a lot of the companies and the conglomerates there to, you know, take some chips off the table in regards to reliance on the U.S. So they started forming alliances with a lot of Chinese companies from the manufacturing side, and, you know, from a lot of banks and financial partners came in from China. As a result, you see a little bit of different monetary policy coming into effect in Mexico versus the U.S. right now. Is asking this one family office about inflation. He said, no, it hasn't been as severe here compared to the U.S. because we've had this infusion of Chinese labor and capital, and it, you know, it's countercyclical to what's happening with the U.S. dollar. So all, you know, all these kind of things start to fit together, and there's no simple formula. But like you said, I don't think it's one day we wake up and everything changes, but it's gradual, and it doesn't have to happen all at once to impact your business or your investment portfolio. And, you know, going back to your original thesis of you guys are recommending holding real assets, I think that's a hedge against all this, right?
It is, because again, as we talked about kind of at the beginning of this segment, you've got these dynamics working against each other, you know, whether you're going to try to fight inflation, whether you're going to, or you're going to try to, you know, soften, you know, the economic landing that looks like it's going to be a hard one to us, at least over the next, you know, throughout the rest of the year and into 24. So, you know, that's a fight that we haven't had to kind of take on for decades. And it's one that just needs to be, you know, addressed, and you need to prepare your kind of portfolio accordingly. Because again, as we've been promoting to our investor base, you know, it's these financial assets, paper assets, which have been in vogue over the past decade and kind of the momentum trades. I'd much rather, as I said, the next decade's going to be different than the last. I'd rather be in real assets, hard assets, as long as they're acquired, right?
Yeah, I mean, due duration risk is one of the things that's really been a trigger for some of these banks failing. I think that my mind goes to the analogy being holding a minerals or managing a minerals portfolio, right? So if you're forced to sell your minerals at the wrong time, and, you know, the natural comparison is you got private equity cost of capital, they want to pull the plug, and, you know, now you're selling at an inopportune time and, you know, commodity price cycles or whatever. The same thing happened with these banks, right? They had I think SVB was long on a lot of 30-year treasuries, right? So
long-term treasuries.
Yeah. So if you were to monetize those early, you know, you have to sell them at a discount. Same thing with minerals. If you hold them for 20 years, you're going to get a lot of value. So it's just setting up your portfolio strategy accordingly. And then, like you guys have done, opportunistically, you can monetize or hedge or do something to create extra upside financially. But anyways, I digress. Darren, pleasure to have you on as always. Your wealth of knowledge. Thank you for sharing your thoughts and your views on the world. I think a lot who are stuck in the weeds buying minerals deals and calling landowners will appreciate your broader view on things. I'll hand it over to you. Any closing comments? Otherwise, I look forward to seeing you in person soon here, if not sooner, at WAPT in Vegas, which is always a phenomenal time. So thanks to you and Kurt for continuing to put on such a tremendous event.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. Always a pleasure, you know, spending time with you talking about the mineral space and a little bit more of the macro side. And I think I'll just add that, you know, it is like, what, you know, your time horizon is very important. So I think for those looking at certain targeted exit timeframes, you might want to look closely at that, because exits might be tougher than one might think when the financing isn't there on the other side. So I would just end with that final point of, like, you know, the larger groups or the larger portfolios exits could pose a problem going forward.
No, I agree. It's just less optionality the bigger you get. It's been a theme for minerals for forever, really, since it's been institutionalized over a decade ago. But with really the need to layer in debt on these larger acquisitions, that's just another headwind against you. That's going to restrict certain groups from playing ball. And if you have a large portfolio looking to exit, it's just less options to look at. So well said. Yeah, thanks again for coming on, Darren. Always great to see you.
Thanks, Tim.
Hey guys, thanks for listening to this episode of the podcast. I hope you enjoyed. The Minerals and Royalties podcast is meant for informational purposes only. Tim Powell and the Minerals and Royalties Authority are not promoting any specific securities or investments, nor are they providing any type of investment advice. If you enjoyed the episode, then I encourage you to tune in more and also check out the Minerals and Royalties Authority YouTube channel. Thanks, and see you next time.